really now ready for your arrival in Beijing?
Modern abstract art that I had in the residence during all of the time that I was in China. I had received color photographs of the interior. This was the downstairs floor, which was the entertainment area. And I took those pictures down to see Mrs. Llewellyn Thompson, who was then, still is, in charge of the Arts and Embassy program of the State Department, which is a very good program. But all of the artists, of course, are living American artists. And I went down to see Mrs. Thompson, the widow of our former ambassador to the Soviet Union, among other things, and said to her, you know so much more about this than I do. Why don't you pick them? And, oh, she said, no, you have to live with them. You must pick them. So we sat side by side on the couch. They bring in the canvases or whatever and hang them in front of us. She would say, "Do you like that?" And I said, "Yes, I think I like that." And what we had in mind was particular places for these photographs that we had in front of us. And then she said, "Do you like that?" "No, I don't like that." About 15 or 20 minutes. Do you like that? "Yes, I think I..." "Oh, no, you don't. You don't. You don't like that." And so after some 2 hours, I chose the paintings with considerable guidance. But I might say that with one exception, and that wasn't a painting, it was a hanging, that everything went fitted in very well. The color schemes went with the basic decoration, which had been put in by Evangeline Bruce with the help of a French interior decorator, and with the essentially utilizing the basic colors of the Temple of Heaven. The Chinese were somewhat mystified by the abstraction. I would say, "Well, what do they mean?" And I'd say, "Well, they mean anything you want it to mean. You just convey your own thoughts to it." But it was quite successful. Also, my swearing in. I had said to the State Department I wanted to be sworn in Detroit, so that I could have a large number of my friends and colleagues come. And the first reaction was, "That's impossible. You have to be sworn in on federal property." "Well," I said, there's federal property in Detroit. As a matter of fact, I said, I was thinking of Federal District Judge Damon Keith, who's a good friend of mine, to do the swearing in, and his courtroom is certainly federal property. I want to know, do I have to be sworn in Washington, and show me where and why I have to be sworn in Washington. So I get a particular department look, and then a few days go by and I get a notice, "My swearing in will take place on the seventh floor in room so-and-so at such and such a time." I hit the ceiling and said, "What happened to my request to be shown that it has to be in Washington?" Well, when I insisted, it was finally admitted it didn't have to be in Washington as long as it was on federal property. I'm not even sure of that, but I accepted that. So we had the swearing in Detroit in Judge Damon Keith's courtroom, and then had a big reception at the Pontchartrain Hotel. Harry Thayer came out,
I remember that.
And he was very much impressed, because from my point of view, it was also politically motivated, because I was thinking about the political struggle that might lie ahead over the question of normalization, and obviously the UAW could be an important factor in that. And in my remarks after the swearing-in, I made a specific comment to that. But then after the swearing-in is when, did we talk about my interview with General Wilson, who was then head of Defense Intelligence?
No.
Who had been with Stilwell in China and in Burma. And I remember saying that the general, I just, not long before that, read Barbara Tuchman's book, Stilwell, General Experience, and asked him, is that book essentially correct? And he said, yes, essentially correct, except in one thing, he said. She wrote that those Chinese troops we had with us in Burma, where we had the control of their training, became first-class soldiers. He said that wasn't quite true. He said they were good on defense, but on offense, they weren't very good at all. And he said quite a lot of them in the Civil War that took place went over to the Red Army, and quite a lot of them fought against us in Korea. He said, somebody must have taught him something in the meantime, because they fought like tigers in Korea, he said. And he also told me about his days as military attaché in Moscow, where he said, I never dreamed in my life I'd hear communists talk about the yellow peril, which is the way in his days in Moscow that the Soviet military and others had talked about China. Subsequently reinforced by Tolstikov, who was the Soviet ambassador in China when I got there, who, after I got to know him quite well, also talked about the yellow peril, and we whites have got to stick together, that sort of thing. Then, also after the swearing-in, I went to the National Security Agency, NSA, to see that huge battery of machines they have in there. They were most concerned about losing their electronic surveillance in Taiwan in the event of normalization. And
did you go out there? Was Bobby Inman the person whom you dealt with when you went out there?
I didn't meet him. No, I didn't meet the head of the agency.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the name of the person. It was a high-ranking person, but they were, as I say, very much concerned about their electronic surveillance in Taiwan and the possibility of maintaining it. Then I had my my final interview before leaving Washington to go back to to get ready to go to China with Bill Gleistein, who of course was Deputy Assistant Secretary for East Asia, and Harry Thayer. And they looked like they wanted to say something but didn't quite know how to say it. And they finally said, we know you're very close to the President, and we hope that you will do business through the department and not through the White House. And I said, you seem to forget that I spent all my life helping run a bureaucracy, and I'm well aware of organizational necessities. And then I think we had mentioned Wang Yao-ting, who was here making a tour of the United States instead of Chinese People's Institute for, what was it, CPIFA?
No, he was CCPIT.
CCPIT.
Hao Dejing was here for CPIFA. That was the person who was here, Hao Dejing.
Hao Dejing.
He was not helpful to the cause when he went up on the Hill, most negative.
Exactly. He had an audience of the most favorable on the Hill to our, to the cause of normalization, and he did the cause great damage. But I had a rather amusing experience with Mr. Howe, because the national the national committee, right?
Right.
Of Charlie Yost.
That's right.
Chairman. They were having their annual membership meeting, and he spoke at the banquet. And he gave his Blood and Thunder speech at the banquet. Well, I wasn't at the banquet. I was at the reception before the banquet, but I didn't stay for the banquet. I had been scheduled long before the China business came along to speak at the breakfast the next morning as the president of the UAW, to speak on labor in the international field. So I prepared my remarks to that title, and I was seated, of course, at the table where Hao Deqing was, and I spoke about the activities specifically of the UAW at the international field and their assistance to unions in third world countries and so on, financial, moral. And I come back to the table, and he says to me, "May I respond?" I was a little surprised, but I said, "Of course." So he gets up. Everybody in that breakfast had been at the banquet the night before except me. So he makes the Blood and Thunder speech all over again, obviously just for my benefit. And when he came and sat down, I said to him through the interpreter that, gently as I could, that I didn't think this was very helpful. As he went west across the country, I understand he did begin to tone it down. And after I got to know him quite well in China, I used to tease him about that speech.
He's a bit of an actor, isn't he?
He loves it.
Just as I recall, he really played on the theme that eventually the Taiwan issue would have to be settled by force.
That was the theme. Right.
And
he spoke as though that, you know, we can do this the day after tomorrow if you don't shape up.
That's right. He, in fact, nearly affected Cy Vance's speech of June up in Washington. He so incensed the Senate that several of the senators called Vance while he was on the plane going to the Asia Society to discourage him from talking about the administration's commitment to normalization.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not surprised, because it was in gross bad taste, for one thing, and certainly politically the worst possible thing that could have been said.
Now, one question in preparation that I'm not clear about, in your preparation for departure, is the following. Whom in the department did you believe to be your principal colleague, handholder?
There.
So the ambassador deals with the country desk officer.
I did, certainly.
Uh-huh. So all communication in the first instance would go to Thayer.
Yes.
But in rank terms, you were, as the State Department ranked these, much higher ranking than he.
Well, the detail was left to Harry Thayer and his and his people.
I see.
When it came to general policy considerations, it would be Dick Holbrooke himself or Bill Gleistein. I spent a lot of time with.
Before you went out.
Before I went out.
So that you established, in effect, an easy personal relationship with three people before you left.
Yes, right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Did you work out ways to communicate directly to each, or did all your communications go through Thayer?
No. I was very freewheeling in that.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, I used to occupy space up in Holbrooke's suite, as well as down on the fourth floor, next to, close to the China desk. I had a room down there too, but I spent just as much time on the sixth floor.
But were you encouraged to say on occasion, did Dick tell you on occasion if there's something especially confidential, you should send something directly to him?
You'd send something in terms of writing?
Once you arrived in Beijing.
In
other words, what kind of arrangements did you make and what kind of arrangements were available to you to write directly or share thoughts with those three? After all, those three individuals, let me indicate why I raised the question. I felt that those three individuals all had their distinctive qualities and that you could share a different kind of dialogue with each of the three. Dick was much more politically attuned. Bill Gleistein, intellectually a superb thinker, aware of the nuances of the relationship, as deeply immersed in it and committed to it as any. Thayer was the superb bureaucratic manager and a very fine person, but also one very sensitive, shall we say, to the problems which any particular initiative would cause, and therefore maybe sometimes a little bit more reluctant, at least I found
very
him a little
cautious,
more reluctant to explore something. He was more cautious than Bill.
Very cautious.
Now, I shouldn't be putting words in your mind, but that was the view I had from the White House, and that there were certain kinds of things, therefore you'd want to talk more with one of them than the other. Stape Roy, obviously intellectually more like Bill. Gleistein.
I had very little contact with Stape.
At that time? Well, he was the key drafter of many of the papers that you read.
Right.
He and Al Romberg on policy planning, with whom you may not have had much contact, really the main drafters, and then I had been working with them up to that time. But it strikes me that as you left, that to the extent that you were to engage in an ongoing discussion, it'd be hard to carry on an ongoing discussion with all three, and I wondered whether you left with the sense that you could have direct correspondence with one or the other in a free-going and it.
There was never any thought
fashion
in my mind that my relationship with Harry, it changed to some degree as time went by, but would be anything but what was required by the normal bureaucratics. On policy questions, on political matters, I was urged to write to Holbrooke and to the secretary himself. I never did, but I was urged repeatedly to keep that in mind.
Good. Phil Habib?
No, Habib did not come into the picture until he accompanied Vance in month later after I got there in August.
Right. That's interesting because I felt Dick was always a little concerned that to keep Phil out of the East Asia.
I don't even think
picture.
I met Phil before. No, I'm not sure I didn't. I think the first time I met Phil to be was in Peking.
That's fascinating,
right.
Because I felt that Dick was a little bit nervous as he was asserting his own authority in the East Asia field, that he did not want to draw Phil heavily into it. Phil had, as you know, been assistant secretary. He was very committed to Korea, committed to normalization. He felt that Phil had gotten involved, he'd run away with the show. When you say that your relations with Harry changed a little bit over time, can we anticipate what you mean by that?
They became much more relaxed, more friendly.
Uh-huh.
You know, Harry would say some things that fell strangely on my ears. One of the almost last things he said to me, very seriously, don't forget you are going to Peking to represent the mightiest power on earth. Which, as I say, fell strangely on my ears. But of course, in this period, Harry had gone through that very traumatic divorce, and then not too long after that he remarried, and that the man himself changed.
Mm-hmm.
He became much more, and his whole emphasis to me was on how horrible Peking was going to be, that he couldn't stand it after, he had to get out after 15 months, the atmosphere was such that I'd be lucky to last 18 months, because it was more than anyone could take. I'm not sure he would have said those kinds of things a year later.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. My relations with him started out very close and effective and deteriorated, but largely because he was cut out of the normalization process until the very end. And I was placed in the unfortunate position of being the enforcer of that. Dick put that on my shoulders, and we had a couple very, very difficult incidents. Every time I think of him, I now have feel very bad, because his dignity, he was a person with great concern for dignity,
yes,
both of the United States and of the dignity of the State Department, and that was a word that just continually reappeared in his conversation. And there's no question that his dignity was really trampled in the normalization process, probably in retrospect unnecessarily, but those were the orders I had. And then Dick, for understandable reasons, did not choose to assist me, but put all the burden on me. He kept arguing that Harry should be included, knowing that the answer would be no, but he wanted, since his relations with Harry were absolutely crucial, he wanted to be seen as a person making the best effort on Harry's.
Harry was always very supportive of me and my mission.
Yes.
Did everything he possibly could to help things along, and I was very grateful to him for that. I found, too, that going through Honolulu on the way to China, I found the sync pack briefings extremely useful. And remember a conversation I had with Admiral Wiesner, as he didn't too much like the notion of giving up the military presence on Taiwan, or that anything should be done about the mutual defense treaty between the Republic of China, Taiwan, and the U.S. When I told him, I said, you know, Admiral, quite a few of the people on Capitol Hill who I've been talking to in my recent visits there, when I would ask them, would you vote to go to war over Taiwan? Oh, good Lord, no. I wouldn't dream of it. He looks at me and says, well, if that's true, we shouldn't have a treaty. I said, I'm convinced it's true, and we're being very hypocritical about this whole business. But I found him very, very intelligent, very, very open-minded, quite apprehensive as to what the future might hold. Then in going through Tokyo, Mansfield at the residence, and he arranged that I had a brief meeting at the residence with Shoji Sato, who was scheduled to go to China as the Japanese ambassador, and I helped that relationship along by learning from him what day he was coming to Peking. It was August the 10th, which was just less than 2 weeks after I'd arrived. And I went out to the airport to greet him, which obviously pleased him. And so that we developed a close personal relationship. And that was important because he was very high ranking in the Japanese Foreign Ministry and confided in me at quite an early time that his job was to try to conclude the peace and friendship treaty between Japan and China, and that when that job was done, he would be leaving. He told me this. His predecessor had spent over 4 years in China, and I was asking him if he expected to spend that long, and he said no, no.
Uh-huh. What was his factional connection, do you remember?
No, I don't know. But he, I think, pushed quite hard to conclude it, and it was my feeling that if Japan concluded that treaty, that it, in political terms, made it somewhat easier for us to take the normalization step. And then also, while I was still in Tokyo, I had lunch with the former Japanese ambassador to China, Ogawa. And when he visited China in a private capacity, he and I spent quite a bit of time together. Now that was after normalization, so that it was sometime in the future. But the relationship with Ambassador Sato was very useful. On the day they concluded the negotiations on the peace and friendship treaty, he came directly from the negotiations, stopped in his office, called me, could I see you? And of course, the Japanese embassy was practically across the street, just around the corner. And he came over to tell me how it was concluded and how they had concluded it. Wanted to make sure that I learned it from him and, mm-hmm. and not in any other way.
We will come back to that subject, I would hope, because the momentum for that really followed Spig's visit.
Yes.
And so we'll come back to that issue. That's fascinating. Leonard, as you flip through the pages, let me ask one other question. Did you have any contact with Soviets before you left? Did anyone from the Soviet embassy in Washington approach you, or
no?
Any foreign governments other than Japanese?
What was his name from the Taiwan? Jimmy Shun. He asked to see me, and I refused.
Uh huh. How was that request conveyed?
It was conveyed through a friend of mine who was a lawyer and whose law firm had some connection with the ROC.
Mm-hmm.
He personally didn't, but his firm did. And he offered to host a luncheon or do whatever to make it.
Was that on your own, or did you go to state?
No, I
didn't. So you just did it. It's interesting. I indicated to Zbig from very early on that he should see Shun, and he said no. And Shun requested to see him later. We're not now talking about 1977, but in 78. And I remember three times going back to him. I said, you ought to, three times, and I gave up. I'm not so sure that we shouldn't have seen a little more of him. But it's a passing thought. One other question as you are prepared to go through Hong Kong and arrive in China. How would you say your views on normalization, this is hard to reconstruct, I think, in the past, but your views on normalization no doubt had become refined as a result of all this preparation. But did you find that your thoughts had altered in any way from your initial instinct that normalization was the right thing to...
No, I can't say they had it. At this juncture, I had no feeling as to how it could be done. I had strong feelings that, yes, it should be done, but
not
nothing beyond that.
One other question along these lines. I remember being deeply impressed by the briefing I received on Sino-Soviet military deployments. I think of the whole range of classified materials to which I had access. The negotiating record was obviously very important. It convinced me that there was no substitute for normalization and that we were really fully locked into a one-China policy as a result of Nixon's 5 points. The other thing that the Sino-Soviet dispute was likely to be an enduring feature at least of Carter administration world affairs, probably for some time after, and that the Soviet force was so overwhelming that we really had a role to play in as a counterweight and ultimately as a provider, if not military equipment, of economic assistance to China, not to threaten the Soviet Union, but to maintain the peace in the region over a sustained period of time. I wonder whether that briefing had any similar impact on you. Do you remember receiving it?
Yes, I do.
It's all you remember, the maps and where the missiles are located and how close the emplacements of permanent hardware was on the border. They couldn't withdraw. I mean, you know, I didn't realize until that time that Soviets can't even withdraw from the border.
It went way beyond anything I had anticipated. And, it was really, in a sense, quite shocking to me that it was that deep and the dispute was that deep and grave. I'm remembering now, too, a session that I had with Vice President Mondale at the White House. Last days I was in Washington, and he, of course, was thoroughly committed to normalization. He put it on purely political terms that if we don't press forward to normalization, and the Chinese should again hook up with the Soviets, that we have a replay of the 50s of who lost China all over again, and the Democrats, as far as the White House was concerned, would be in the wilderness for a generation. So he viewed it in a purely domestic sense, as he saw it. But he was very, very strong in his comments in that regard. I went from Tokyo to Peking. I flew on CAAC. The Far Eastern Economic Review, Derek Davis, made the comment that Woodcock thinks he can slip into Peking as a simple labor leader who flies their own aircraft. Impress the Chinese, he is very much mistaken. They, like all communists, adore capitalists. I'm not sure that I picked CAAC just because it was CAAC. It just happened to fit the schedule when I was going through, but I was.
So you didn't go in through Hong Kong?
No, no. Oh. No, I flew directly from Tokyo. And we arrived late on the night of July 26th. About 8 o'clock or so at night. And I you don't see many lights, as you know, when you come into Peking Airport. And my thoughts were very mixed. I was really quite apprehensive about what the future might hold. Practically all the American staff was at the airport to give me a very warm greeting. And I might say that right from the beginning, the professional staff were extremely, extremely good in their relationship with me.
You had a very strong staff in David Dean as DCN.
Right. And there were quite a few other ambassadors out there to greet the new American. It was 14 or 15 of them, as I remember it, which was quite reassuring in a sense.
Were any Chinese officials there from the ministry?
Yes, I think Lin Ping was there. I'll take that back. I don't know. I forget who was there.
Mm-hmm.
But there was somebody there from protocol. It was not the chief of protocol. And the journalists, not American, there weren't any there. And they were, I'd expected some tough questions. In fact, I turned and said to a colleague nearby, they're just pussycats. They're just pussycats. They were, one or two asked questions that could have led to tougher ones, but certainly unlike the press that I'd been used to.
You arrived then when the Vance date was well set, and
yes,
the planning for his trip was quite advanced.
Oh, yes.
You arrived at the time of the Party Congress, or on...
couple of days after I was there, the masses were in the streets celebrating the return to power of Deng Xiaoping.
I was going to say there's a poignancy to that you arrived at the time that Deng returned.
And, I must say, looking back, they seem quite joyous. My first reaction was, well, they're instructed to be happy, to be joyous. But then, some 3 weeks later, they were in the streets again to celebrate something or other, and their attitude at that time was, well, here we are again. Seemed quite bored by it all. And you could, watching those events on television, the response to Deng Xiaoping was much stronger than the response to the others, including even at that beginning time to Hua Guofeng. Whether it was for Deng Xiaoping as himself, or whether it was to Deng Xiaoping as the protege of Zhou Enlai, I've never been able to clear in my mind, but it was clearly right from the beginning he had a strong personal plus. And I was in China only for 3 or 4 days when Wang Hua, the foreign minister, received me. And we also had 2 diplomatic receptions. And afterwards, some months afterwards, the ambassador from Guinea said to me, "Didn't you know there were never so many black faces for a white ambassador in this city before?" And his point was that we are pleased you are who you are, and we are also pleased with the Carter policy on Africa.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And the reason we had 2 receptions is that there were just too many. Assuming an almost total response, which is what we got. So we had it on the Friday evening on the 29th of July, and on the Monday evening, the 1st of August. And it was a very substantial, show of support to the United States. Then I...
What were your first impressions of Wang Hua, and what did you cover in that session? Was it courtesy, or did it touch on Taiwan, on Vance's visit?
I don't think so. And of course, Wang Hua, you know, can be a vanity itself. And he was very charming, and
he has a rather impressive range of emotions that he can display, I think.
Yes, he can be very nasty. Very nasty when he wants to be, and also
very snide and patronizing and.
And then on the Tuesday, Wong Hai-rung, who was then still in charge of the Americas, vice foreign minister in charge of the Americas and Oceania, gave a luncheon for me at the Hotel. She was a little sharp in her comments about the U.S.-China relationship. Had we been a little more acutely responsive ourselves, we should have known then that what finally happened to her would happen, that she was not in tune with the new day.
But you sensed that at that time, that the nuances were different in your meeting with her and with Wang Hua?
Only in looking back.
Looking back.
Only in looking back. No.
Well, I think also we sensed that. I mean, we learned about that difference later. But she also was not, shall we say, as trained as to just carry on a rather light luncheon conversation. I found it very difficult to talk to her.
Well, later after Sharon and I got married. Still in her post and was at the residence many times. She got some delight out of encouraging Sharon to be the individualist and not to let me interfere in her personal internal affairs and so on.